The Athletic.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. My name is Taylor Payne, and coming up on this week's episode, we're going to rake over the coals of one of the worst games of football I've ever witnessed, the 0-0 of the West Brom. We'll be returning to Takeover Land to find out the latest with the club's ongoing arbitration proceedings. We'll be taking you back in time to relive the arrival of Rafa Benitez 5 years on from the day he rocked up at St James's Park. And the quiz returns, and this week George is in the hot seat and asking the questions. Before we get to all of that, George and Chris, how are you doing? I think the question on everybody's lips, Chris, is how's your chin?
My chin has just, it's recovering. It's still there, the scar. The battle scar is still there, but I have new, I suppose you could call them wounds, in that I have also, I've Alice has been let loose on my hair again. This time there aren't tram lines, but I do have a sort of triangular shaped head. I don't have any hair on my forehead, but then if you go back, it like tapers up and it looks like I've got a triangular shaped head.
I have seen the picture, Chris, and it is absolutely incredible what your wife has done to you. You look like a rendering of a footballer from an old computer game. That's what you've got, like a geometric head. It's incredible, and that matched with the scar on your chin. I mean, Christopher Waffles,
Mr. Triangle with his horizontal shaving injury. It's just what are we supposed to do?
George, you're meant to be guiding this lad through his, you know.
I've tried my best. At the Athletic, we're supposed to have this kind of scheme where we're mentoring people. I don't know what to do.
He's
with
lost
Chris.
Cause, isn't he?
I mean, I think it says a lot about you that I have turned out this way, so.
Maybe there's a point there, yeah. Maybe I need to look at myself in the mirror. I
mean, how are you, George? How are you doing? Are you okay?
Yes, I'm okay. I mean, yes, it's a bit sort of dispiriting listening to that, isn't it, from Chris? But no, apart from that, I'm all right, yeah.
It's been a hectic week, hasn't it?
Is hectic the right word?
Oh, it's been shit, hasn't it, George? Let's be honest.
Yes, okay, yes. But come on, let's save that up. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm not too bad. I've grown a bit of facial hair over the last couple of weeks, and my hair started getting longer. And the Ben said to us the other day, "Daddy, you look a little bit like Captain America on one of the Avengers films." And I thought, "Oh, that's quite good." And then the other one went, "Yeah, but loads fatter." So that's nice.
Okay, Captain America,
right. Yeah. So that's me. Before we jump headlong into a pool of despair, I need to fill everyone in on the latest offer from The Athletic. So right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of $3.99 a month for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, possibly wearing vests, I don't know. As well as free ad versions of all the podcasts. Chaps, have we got any good articles coming up at the minute? Anything for the listeners and the readers to keep an eye out for?
Well, over the last few days, we have had some very, very uplifting pieces, obviously, given the situation Newcastle United are in. So George and I, along with a couple of our colleagues, Adam Crafton and David Ornstein, did a big piece looking at Richie versus Bruce, which we'll get on to, but basically whether that is just one incident that has just flared up, or whether it's sort of more emblematic of what is going on within the club. Also did a piece, George and I, with Matt Slater. Matt Slater did the majority of it on the arbitration case and what exactly Newcastle's statement last week meant. And then I also did a piece after the wonderful game at the Hawthorns, basically looking at Newcastle's decision to go there and try and eke out a draw against a side who are absolutely hopeless. So some three very enjoyable reads for you there.
I have done a piece on a year without fans, and so that should be going up by the time that this podcast is out. And what I sort of did, in a strange cheating sort of sense, I tried to kind of recreate a day in the northeast. So I went to the Stadium of Light, where Sunderland were playing at home, but I went to a bar in Newcastle City Centre, and I went to the Riverside Stadium as well. And over the course of a kind of morning afternoon, try to talk to long-standing fans about not being there over the past year, how that's felt, and what football might look like when it comes back. And I talked to a couple of people who, you know, had missed one game for two decades or more, and how it felt suddenly. And a lot of that was kind of quite sad in some ways, and it was quite, you know, evocative, I suppose, and emotive about that sort of sense of ritual that we've lost. And really what we've lost, of course, is human connection. So it's kind of all about that, really.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, when all this started and we found out that football was going to go behind closed doors, I think none of us thought it would still be a year later. We'd still be waiting for the stadiums to reopen. But, you know, there is a bit of light at the end of the tunnel now. There's talk of the European Championships being played with crowds and stuff like that. So you never know, do you? Let's see what the future holds. Anyway, if you want to catch up any of those articles from George and Chris, get yourself to theathletic.com/podonthetyne and take advantage of the special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/podonthetyne. Anyway, chaps, let's tackle the first thing on our list here. The West Bromwich Albion game. I normally, before we do these podcasts, I make a load of notes and I put a load of stuff down on my tablet just so I've got some little headings to read from as we go through. And I have one word under the West Bromwich Albion game, and it is dog shit. I don't really know any other way to describe it, chaps.
Is that one word or is that two words?
I think it's one word.
I think dog shit's one word, personally. Dog shit.
Yeah, I think it's
okay.
One word.
Yeah, I can see that on the... On the running order, yeah, it hasn't sort of highlighted it as a spelling mistake. So, yeah, okay, one word, fine. Sorry, Chris.
Excellent. Go on, Chris.
Well, I was just going to say that you mentioned it's a year since fans have been in. That Sunday was the first away game I've covered for Newcastle in a year, exactly a year. So I was at Southampton last year, and then because we are only getting one reporter from The Athletic in the most grounds because of the restricted access. George was cup correspondent early in the season and went to a few. But I didn't even know I was going to West Brom until last Thursday when I got a message from one of the editors saying that you have a pass. And so I delightfully drove the 7-hour round trip to go and watch most fulfilling match I've ever seen in my life.
So you stepped in to dog shit.
Exactly. I mean, you know what was most incredible? So after the game on I was chatting to our West Brom reporter, Steve Madeley, and I was just saying about how awful the game was, and he said, oh, that's probably only the third or fourth worst game I've seen this season. And I was like,
Oh my god.
Hey, well, maybe it's not just Newcastle, yeah. Then. Maybe, you know. Maybe,
well, yeah. I mean, I sat and watched that game, and I thought this is possibly one of the worst games of inverted commas Premier League football I've ever seen. I mean, if that's an advert for the Premier League, then, you know, it was awful, wasn't it?
It was pure
it
championship.
Was garbage.
It was 100% championship.
Bottom half championship.
Yeah.
Bottom half of the championship, yeah, it was. It was exactly like that, and it was like, hello next season. Hello at EFL. I better start following you again. It just made you feel like that. I mean, there was no quality
anywhere.
And I mean, they ran around and, you know, I know they came out afterwards and sort of said that they were there, you know, they were trying to win and everything, but it felt to me like sort of containment, and it felt to me like without those three players in attack that this was sort of, you know, it was kind of damage limitation, it felt like. But I think, you know, that approach was then shown up by what happened with Fulham at Liverpool afterwards. So it was just dispiriting. It was just dispiriting.
I mean, it's not what you need, is it, when you're in a position where you don't want to be going away and playing against a team that's below you in the league and not having a go at them. I mean, we were toothless in front of goal. It felt like the system didn't really suit the players that were in it. And there wasn't a recognisable striker on the pitch as such. I mean, Joe Linton was doing a mild impression of a striker, but he was drifting wide and playing in that sort of split striker role that he has been recently. But it was just turgid, wasn't it, Chris? It just didn't get going at all. And I was waiting for the game to come to life, and it just never happened.
Yeah, turgid is the word. And I mean, you mentioned the system, and I'd said a couple of weeks ago I had a bit of an issue with it. I think that the way I look at it is that system is essentially built A, around John Joe Shelvey, trying to get the most out of him midfield, and B, the front three positions are basically trying to get the most out of Almiron as a sort of false nine, whatever position you want to call it. Then you've got Callum Wilson, who can play as that sort of split forward, and then Alan Saint-Maximin giving a bit of a free roll on the other side. And the you could just see the players weren't particularly comfortable with it at the weekend. The one thing that did work in the first 20 minutes was to try and get the ball in behind the fullbacks, the West Brom fullbacks, and then both Fraser and Joe Linton managed to get in behind. But I just thought that the players didn't look overly comfortable, didn't necessarily know where they needed to be. I mean, Joe Willock, Bruce came out afterwards and said, oh, Joe Willock's played as a number 10 at Arsenal, his career. But it's not a number 10 position. When people are talking about as a number 10, you tend to have a forward directly in front of you who you're feeding, or you have the players either side. It's not that sort of position. It's sort of a hybrid between being a deep lying striker and also being a slightly advanced midfielder. And I thought we saw glimpses from, but equally, he isn't someone who is going to be in the six-yard box all the time. Dwight Gayle came on and played in almost exactly the same position once he eventually came on, and there just wasn't that threat. And I thought Ryan Fraser was almost an interesting case appointed, because usually the one thing you get from Ryan Fraser is he's very, very direct. As soon as he gets somewhere, he'll cross the ball in the box. But there was a couple of times, particularly in the first half, where he hesitated before he put the ball into the area because there wasn't anyone there. And that's very unlike Ryan Fraser. There was just no real attack and threat, certainly after the first 20 minutes. And at the end, Newcastle were essentially hanging on. They were hanging on to try and get a draw. And in the piece that I wrote, that the issue is at some point, Newcastle have to win games. They can't. Yes, they've got 2 points from the last two games. And Steve Bruce talked about, I mean, I know there's not a lot of supporters when he came out and talked about the run that Newcastle are on.
The run, yeah, God almighty.
Here, which he got incorrect, but even if you go beyond that, the run actually is two wins in 18 games. And still the run is actually 2 points from the last 12. That is the run that Newcastle United are on. They're going to have to go and beat someone. They're going to have to get themselves out of this position. And if they go to second bottom West Brom and try and get a draw, they go to bottom of the table Sheffield United, try to get a draw and lose, who can they reasonably expect to try and beat in the next few weeks? Are they going to go to Brighton a week on Saturday and try out for the draw? Because if they are, then who are they going to try and beat? That's the problem they had. I mean, Steve Bruce says that they did try to win the game. Paul Dummett came out and afterwards, but on all the evidence of what I saw, it was very much a team selection of we cannot lose this game. And if Fulham had lost, then it would have been an okay point. But because Fulham won, Newcastle went up a position. But actually, realistically, that their actual situation has just become even worse.
I think the sort of thing is that all of us thought, I mean, certainly I did, you know, a few weeks ago, that Newcastle would be safe by virtue of other clubs being shitter. So, you know, that 10-point cushion, whatever it was, with the bottom three, that was massive. And there were clubs beneath them. You know, there were a lot of clubs beneath them. So although we knew that Newcastle weren't playing very well and you know, and all the rest of it, there was that cushion. And that cushion looked big enough. And it's almost like that mentality is still there with the team. And so, you know, I think us and fans and everybody are sort of thinking that this is a really parlous and terrible situation. But they're playing as if getting the odd point like that will sort of maintain that buffer. But it's not there anymore. And I think that mentality, it feels to me like that seeped into things. That when the manager's been asked about it, when the players have been asked about it, they've talked about five or six other teams being in it. They've talked about looking up the table. They've talked about, you know, wanting to try and finish in the top 10 and that kind of stuff, even, you know, very, very recently. But this is an absolute dogfight. And you look, I mean, I said this on Twitter after the match. It was in response to somebody. But I said, you know, the difference is Newcastle are playing as if they're content to stay up. Fulham are playing as if they're desperate to stay up. And that is a big, you know, that is a big difference. And I do sort of think all this stuff about remits and all that kind of stuff, it's like, okay, well, this club is settling for staying up. But that's not enough. You've got to absolutely fight tooth and nail for it. You've got to be relentless. And Fulham are being relentless. And it's part of that. You know, they've had one aim all season, Fulham, and that is to stay up. And Newcastle had it when, you know, when we came up. And Leeds have had it this season, you know. And there is that sort of thing. Fulham had a terrible start, but they're in this. You can just look at them. You look at the way they're playing, and it's properly full on.
Yeah, yeah.
And Newcastle absolutely are not full on. Newcastle don't have that same sort of thing, and it is that sort of being sucked into it. And it's like if any part of that thinking at the weekend was that, well, a point will be good because that'll stretch the gap to 4 points, and Fulham will lose. You know, Fulham will lose at Liverpool.
You just can't be counting on that anymore, can you?
You can't do that.
If you look at the form table from before Christmas to now, we are stone cold bottom of it. We are absolutely adrift of everybody else in the league by quite a way as well. I'm worrying that we're getting further and further towards the end of the season and nobody seems to have realised just how perilous this is yet. And it's almost like there's a delusion around the club of, you know, we'll be fine. Other teams are worse than us. We'll be fine. But if one thing Newcastle United's taught you over the years is just presuming that other teams are going to do you a favour is not enough, is it? We've been relegated twice off the back of that and it's just not good enough at the minute and questions have to be asked. We spoke weeks ago about grown-up conversations being had within the club and it seems like they still haven't been had. So I don't know what the next step is, Chris. I don't know where they go from here, especially with Bruce and everything that's come out this week about the players and about people being unhappy in the training ground and in the dressing room. What is the next step here? Because I can't see where this turns round. It feels like free fall at the minute.
I agree. I can't see where it turns around, but all the indications are at the moment, at least from what we're getting, that there isn't, that a change is not necessarily imminent. I certainly expect Steve Bruce is going to be in charge for Friday night against Aston Villa, which again is another huge match. We see it every single week, but you just look now at Brighton a week on Saturday and you think, because that's going into the international break, and surely if Newcastle haven't picked up at least one win from the next two, then that surely has to be a time where if Newcastle are going to make a change, and it's going to have to be at that point, you would like to think. But as you say, that the Richie bust up, what however you want to refer to it,
altercation.
However you want to go. I mean, Steve Bruce came out on Friday and said that these things happen up and down on training grounds all over the country every week, and I'm sure it is true that there is raised tension. Well, I know that it's true, and you get various examples of it. I suppose the one difference is that Richie allegedly called his manager a coward, and I don't think you often get that up and down training grounds. The club haven't denied that the case. They didn't admit that was the case either, but they haven't denied that was the case, and it's just, I think that's almost a case in point, as George and I explained in this long piece that we've written, that Richie was, he's part of the core group of players who Steve Bruce has referred to for so long. He was, we referred to him as a true believer in the piece. He's someone who, when Steve Bruce first came in, he was adamant that Steve Bruce was the right man for the job and that he didn't understand all the criticism. And eventually, Steve Bruce was influential in helping Matt Ritchie get another contract. And yet, there was this flare-up last week, and allegedly within it, that Matt Ritchie tells Steve Bruce that he's done nothing for him. And so it just shows, I think, discontent, at least from some of the players who were there. We've had the Carl Darlow situation, and it just feels like there's loads of little fires going off around Newcastle at the moment, and all of it is just adding up to... all of it's adding together and creating this uncertain situation. And all of it just feels wrong. It like in 2015-16, it didn't feel right. For much of the 2008-09 season, it didn't feel right. And unfortunately, those sort of lingering feelings of that something's wrong here, just it feels eerily similar this time.
What was that noise, Chris?
That wasn't
just
me.
Throw something at the wall.
It was me. I just dropped my pen.
That was a pen.
It was a pen.
Jesus,
yeah.
That's a big
I'll
pen.
Do it again.
Go on.
There you go.
Bloody hell.
There you go.
Impressive stuff. I feel like I'm coming down on the side of Matt Ritchie with this one, because I feel I would feel really pissed off if what had happened to the team, which happened in the game where the message got sent on and there was a bit of miscommunication and the goal was scored. If my manager had came out after the game and kind of essentially thrown me under the bus, I would have been massively pissed off with that. And then allegedly confronting him about it and saying, no, we'll deal with it at training on Tuesday and all that. I can see Matt Ritchie's the character that would build up a head of steam about this, wouldn't he? And I don't think he would be the type of person who would just let it go. He would have to say his piece and he would have to make his point. And I think if you're going to start throwing around sort of accusations about what's happened on the pitch and stuff like that, the manager's there to take collective responsibility on behalf of the team, isn't he? He's not there to deflect the blame onto the players. The best managers always deflect the blame away from the players rather than onto them, don't they? This is what I would say.
Yeah. No, I mean, we know that the kind of fella that Matt Ritchie is. I mean, when he's happy, he boots a teammate up the arse. When he's happy, he boots a corner flag into a supporter's nuts. I mean, that's what he does when he's happy, let alone when he's unhappy. And he has his own reasons for feeling sort of disaffected at the minute, from not being in the team to not getting back to Bournemouth in the David Ornstein column at the start of this week. It was reported that he'd actually sort of packed up his locker in January but was kind of gone. So, you know, there are personal things and, you know, that sense of these things happen. It's definitely true, but they can be laughed off if your team's doing okay or if you're winning matches. It's impossible to laugh off in these circumstances. And there are sort of all sorts of whispers around the club. And, you know, we spoke to people and, you know, there are sort of questions about training. There are questions about days off, all those sort of little things coming out. And again, you know, to a certain extent, every dressing room is split because you've always got players who think the manager's a dick for not picking them. And you've always got players who like the manager because they are being picked. You've got all these little jealousies and things like that happen absolutely all the time. But the final sort of arbiter is results. So it's very easy to paint this picture of an unhappy camp because you've got all these things happening at the same time as results. And players have to buy into managers. They have to buy into that. So the idea is, okay, we might be getting asked to do something that we don't want to do, whether it's, you know, having a day off cancelled or running for half an hour when you prefer to play five-a-side. But if you get results at the end of it and you see it works, then that's fine. You accept it and you buy into it. And you go with it. When results do not go your way, you question everything. You know, that's the problem for Steve Bruce at the minute, that whatever he's doing and whatever he's saying, it's palpably not working in terms of results.
It's not, is it? And obviously, Bruce has been slightly sort of combative in his press conferences and in his interviews and stuff like that. He seems to be very stuck fast on not walking away from the situation. And I wouldn't imagine for a minute that he ever would walk away from the situation, Chris. I think he's here for the long haul, isn't he? If Bruce is going to leave, or it's going to be him getting sacked rather than him resigning, isn't it?
Yeah, well, actually, at Friday's pre-match press conference, I got to ask a question for the first time in a while, so it's still like two or three, sometimes four questions from the written media, and I was able to ask one on Friday, which was a pretty extraordinary press conference in which we'd heard about leaks and various different...
Moles as well.
About that. Moles, yeah, all of this. there was also, it wasn't in our section of the press conference, but there was also... the stuff about treason and the leaks coming out and things like that. But I asked Steve Bruce, I said to him, do you expect to be Newcastle United manager next season? At this point, do you expect to be Newcastle United manager? And he's basically, his response was, well, I hope so. And then he was also asked by someone else, have you thought about walking away given everything that's been going on? And he said, no, not for a second. It makes me even more determined. And so Steve Bruce is not going to go anywhere of his own accord. He still believes that he can turn this around. He still believes that Newcastle United are going to be in the Premier League next season. They're only a point above the relegation zone now, albeit they've got a game in hand on the team below them, but the team two below them, sorry. But yeah, it's going to be whether the club will act or not. And from the piece that George and I wrote 10 days ago, so Newcastle are still not in the relegation zone. That's historically when they've acted. There were even suggestions. I mean, David Ornstein mentioned them again on them in the video that I've done with them for Ask Ornstein for The Athletic this morning, that there's even been suggestions, at least from some people, that there isn't beyond the realms of possibility that even if Newcastle went down, that Steve Bruce would remain in charge. They're all the what-ifs, and it's very different if Newcastle were actually dropping the relegation zone. I think that focuses minds, but I don't think that we're still at the stage where it's inevitable that Steve Bruce goes. I think to look forward to next season, though, and to envisage next season, regardless of what division Newcastle are in, and if there can be full crowds back and Steve Bruce in charge, I still can't see how that would work. I can't see how that as an atmosphere would work. But at the moment, it doesn't look imminent that he's going anywhere.
Hello listeners, sorry to interrupt your show, but we've got a small favour to ask. We're currently doing a bit of a survey to find out more about you, your podcast listening habits, and the sort of adverts that are most relevant to you. If you feel like helping, please head to surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. That's pretty catchy, so I'll say it one more time. surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. Thank you.
We We're going to talk a little bit about the takeover and the arbitration case and proceedings that that Newcastle have at the moment against the Premier League. And Mike Ashley released a statement during the week. And I'll be honest, as a Newcastle fan, it's the longest statement I've read coming out of the club in the 10-plus years that he's been here. Astonishing goings on at the minute, Chris, in the courts. And I mean, I'm a bit of a Luddite when it comes to the law and order stuff, so I don't know if you can fill in the gaps here for me, but Newcastle requested the removal of the chairman of the arbitration panel and the High Court ruled against them. And that's kind of the top and bottom of what I've got from it.
Yeah, so just as George and I were in the middle of sort of compiling this piece on Bruce versus Ritchie and sort of focusing minds on that, all of a sudden this Newcastle statement just popped up. Club update, I think, was the headline. Nothing else in it. And I mean, we hear from Newcastle so infrequently, but this is I think the third or fourth, certainly at least the third.
We're hearing from Big Mike absolutely all the time on this.
Yes, on this. So and so in that sense, I welcome the fact that they are communicating a little bit more on this, but it also just draws more attention to the fact that they're not communicating on anything else. But we'll get on to that in a second. In terms of what the actual statement was about, it was about. Well, it's about the takeover situation, but basically about arbitration, but the arbitration panel. So I'll try and sum this up briefly. The way arbitration works is there is a three-person panel appointed. The Premier League proposes someone. Newcastle United proposed someone. So the Premier League have proposed Lord Dyson. Newcastle have proposed Lord Neuberger. And then between them, they collectively agree on who the chair of it should be. And collectively, they both agreed on someone called Michael Bailoff. Subsequently, the Premier League's lawyers revealed that Michael Bailoff had given advice to the Premier League back in 2017 when they had basically changed part of their owners and directors test. And usually in these sort of circumstances, at least having listened to many legal experts, this is perfectly normal. It's just the sort of thing you'd reveal and nobody would have objection to it. But Newcastle have objected to it on the basis that they think that Michael Bailoff in some way would be biased or at least can't be put in a position where he can make a decision on this. And so try to have him removed. Couldn't get him removed just of their own accord, so then took the Premier League, or took the situation to the High Court to try and get Bailoff removed. They have lost that case, so Bailoff will be on the three-man arbitration panel. The arbitration, which has still not begun because of this, so this was in October this happened. We're now into March and the arbitration has not begun because Newcastle appealed against this. There was also a second point where Newcastle tried to get the arbitration hearing itself to be made in public, because arbitration usually happens privately. So Newcastle also lost on that point, but what they did win on was the ability for these judgments to be released because they'd been in the High Court. So it was a very unusual thing that Newcastle asked for arbitration to be made public, and it just seemed very interesting. The club, who speaks so little about so many different things, were so keen on open transparency on this one point, which is great in one sense because it would be great to have it out there, but it would be atypical for this to be in public because arbitration hearings usually are private and sometimes you don't even hear the ins and outs of them after the arbitration has even concluded.
It's another twist and turn, isn't it, in the story of this takeover, and you know, it's so many years in the making now, and we're hopefully coming towards the end of it. George, I mean, where does the process currently stand? Chris is saying the arbitration hasn't started yet. What's the possible outcomes here from this?
Well, we're no further forward in terms of possible outcomes, but what we are is 4 months down the line, and we're still waiting for arbitration to begin. So, I mean, I'm saying the club have wasted 4 months. It's wasted because they've lost this challenge, and they could yet appeal it. So, yeah. I mean,
so we could be here for a while yet.
I mean, the other kind of interesting thing is that, you know, is the statement that there is from Ashley that he is still committed to get the takeover through, and you know, wanting the best for Newcastle fans and whatever else it was. I'm paraphrasing there, but you know, obviously with the situation that it is that the team is in, that side of the club is in, it raises all sorts of questions, doesn't it? Because the closer we get to the end of the season, the closer we get to potentially relegation, the closer we get to Newcastle's worth being a lot less than it is now, and you know, so it as always with these statements, as always with this process that's been going on for so freaking long now, you know, we're left, every single thing that happens just opens up another round of questions and uncertainty and delay.
Can I just focus in on the point of what arbitration is about as well. I think that it's sort of, I think some people maybe have got a little bit confused and think that, if and when arbitration, the hearing comes back, and if it comes out positively on Newcastle's side, then suddenly the takeover definitely happens.
The takeover's done. It's not.
The arbitration point, it's over one specific point, and that specific point is whether the Saudi state would be a shadow director of Newcastle United, and therefore they themselves should be put through the owners and directors test. The argument from Newcastle United and from the prospective buyers is that the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund is a separate entity from the Saudi government. The argument the Premier League are making is that because there are Saudi officials on the board of PIF, and that basically it is part of the state itself, that therefore the state has to be put through the owners and directors test. So we're trying to determine at the moment whether that is the case. And if it is the case, then it seems difficult to comprehend how the takeover could necessarily happen, given all the negative publicity there's been over the last year of various different things, piracy, obviously, Khashoggi, everything on that those sorts of levels. But even if Newcastle and the prospective owners, arbitration falls on their side, it doesn't necessarily mean the takeover definitely happens. They've still got to go through the rest of the owners and directors test. It makes it a lot more likely, but it isn't just if Newcastle win arbitration, suddenly the takeover definitely happens and will happen immediately. We're not actually at that stage yet, so that's how frustrating things still are.
The quote on the official website says, "The club is committed to the speedy and fair determination of its claims so that the proposed takeover can go ahead as soon as possible. However, it felt it had to make this application given the need for the dispute to be determined by way of fair process, and that they're still considering an appeal." But again, the point is that this has already taken 4 months. And so you can argue by doing this, they've actually moved further away from the takeover happening, because, as I say, with the end of the season sort of fast approaching, you know, who knows what the club is worth? Who knows whether it could go ahead in those circumstances?
Right, well, we'll move on now. We're going to come to our archive. And this week, we're going to be going back just 5 short years to the day that Rafa Benitez rolled up to St James's Park in a silver people carrier and his corduroy jacket, jumped out, went inside, had a meeting with Lee Charnley and became Newcastle United manager.
Deflects it and in off Stephen Taylor, and Bournemouth take the lead. And here's King in on goal. What a chance! What a finish! And is that the finish of Steve McClurdy?
It was a frenzied few minutes here. A blacked out people carrier just travelling down Barrack Road here. Everyone hot footed down to one of the entrances and caught first glimpse of Rafa Benitez arriving here at St James's Park. He's here, he's in Newcastle. Steve McClaren, of course, only sacked this morning at 10:30. Official confirmation from Newcastle at 11:30. And then our first glimpse of Rafa Benitez just around 15 minutes ago.
The first thing is, for me, the fans, the statue of the club and the future. So I have seen all these things together. I said in my press conference that I came here because that. So a lot of positive things here from day one. Everything together means that I'm really pleased, really happy to be here.
It's astonishing that it's 5 years, isn't it? Isn't it?
It doesn't feel like 5 years, but at the same time, it feels like twice as long as that. I don't know if that makes sense, but
the fabulous thing, though, isn't it? You know, 5 years on, look at the club now.
I know.
Look at where Newcastle is.
Look at how
it's
far
so
we've
great.
Come.
I mean, I know it was such a terrible place back now. But
we'd never
time,
find
like,
ourselves in that
no.
position again, would we? God, no. Oh.
Sorry, I was thinking about a completely different club there.
Yeah.
No, we're in exactly the same position, aren't we?
A normal club that isn't a complete fucking bin fire, yeah.
The elbows on that jacket, though, were quite incredible. I still have that vision of when he arrives in that suit and he's got the sort of elbow patches on. They are quite
a geography cool. teacher.
They
geography
make those jackets patches. For history and geography teachers. That's what they make them jackets for. I had one of those when I was a college lecturer a few years ago. I went and bought a corduroy jacket with elbow patches. I wasn't asked to manage a Premier League club, though, so I'm slightly disappointed about that. But Rafa came in with such pedigree and such a great CV at a time when the club was struggling. Obvious parallels to the situation that we're in at the moment with Steve McLaren losing games and losing favour with the fans and stuff like that. And Rafa Benitez came in and instantly lifted the mood, didn't he? Came in, had that meeting, and then took training that night with the players in his tracksuit and stuff like that. And I mean, looking back at the time as a fan, it gave you an instant injection of hope, didn't it? It kind of instantly changed the mood around the club, and it changed the story, and it made everything feel a little bit better. And I know we didn't manage to get out of that position in that season. We still got relegated. But for that few weeks as when Rafa came in, the mood around the club lifted massively, didn't it, Chris?
It did. And I mean, let's just go back to the week leading up to it. So Newcastle beaten 3-1 at home by Bournemouth, absolutely embarrassingly done over by a team who've just been promoted. It's clear it's McLaren's, is on his last legs. But then there was an excruciating week where Steve McLaren still has to take training as Newcastle's board at the time, the football board, quote unquote, were basically meeting up in York and then spending the week trying to find his replacement. Steve McLaren was having it. It was excruciating. I thought it was really, really handled very, very badly that week that he had to go in and take training.
Yeah.
It was the last to know exactly what was going on. But then at the time I was still working for the Chronicle and Journal. I remember the Monday or sort of Tuesday trying to find out who maybe they could go for. And if Rafa Benitez had sort of been mentioned by a couple of people, but I just didn't see any realistic. And I'm going to embarrass myself here and say at the time I was sort of pushing for someone like Nigel Pearson just to give them a kick on the backside.
Because I didn't, you and Peter Schmeichel, both of you here.
I didn't see it as being realistic that Rafa Benitez, who'd been at Real Madrid 4 months before, three months before, wasn't even 3 months before, would trade that for Newcastle United in the position to win under Mike Ashley, third bottom of the Premier League, heading for the Championship, everything that had gone on. I just couldn't see how that was going to happen. And yet, absolutely extraordinary, he took that challenge when he came. And he saw the potential in Newcastle. He saw that it was a club that was on its knees but could be lifted again. And just I still remember how amazed I was that week and that weekend when he came in that press conference. It remains astonishing now.
And those words like hope and potential and history and stature, they were so important to everybody. And that was the point about his management at the club, that it did remind people that actually there was something quite good about Newcastle, or could be, if to use that phrase of Rafa's, people did things the right way or did things right. But we're interspersing a few clips from an interview I did with him just before Christmas and that interview was about the film coming out, We Are the Geordies, the brilliant film that we've talked about on the podcast. And he talked also about, you know, the risk to his own reputation by coming in.
When I went to Newcastle United, it was an opportunity to keep a top side, a big club in the Premier League, and try to build something from there. We couldn't do it, and it was a very difficult decision, because we were coming from Real Madrid, and we were successful in Napoli. We won two titles in Napoli. So I was coming to the Premier League because I wanted to stay close to the family, and Newcastle United was a challenge. It was an opportunity to be the top side that wanted to be at the level that they deserve to be. So to go down, the emotion of the last game and the promise that we will spend and we will compete, it's okay. We analyze everything. We take the challenge. It was a big risk. I don't see any top manager at this time taking the risk. We did it because we felt the love and the support of the fans, and we thought that we could do it. And again, I would say it was a very, very risky decision, because nobody knows the championship, how difficult is the championship.
Of course, Rafa signed an initial 3-year deal with a get-out clause, didn't he, if the club got relegated? And obviously that is what came to pass. That last day of the season will live long in the memory of the game against Spurs, the 5-1 win. I was actually in Germany at the time in a pub in Munich for my birthday, watching the game on the TV. And at the time, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing, and the noise and the crowd and everyone got
Was that just because of the beer?
Well, I was drunk, so that didn't help. But
I couldn't believe what I was seeing, which was three of everything.
Oh, yes. But it was just an incredible day, wasn't it? And I think Rafa's been on record as saying that was the day that he kind of, the decision was made for him, and he said, how can I leave these people? I believe that was something he said, had said to his daughters, how can I leave these people with the reaction like that? And I think we showed him how much we loved him, and he returned that to us with a grain to stay in the Championship. And that is a massive thing for a man of Rafa Benitez's stature to do. Take a dive like that down into a lower league, and potentially risk his own reputation on it. It was huge.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you forget in retrospect sort of what hard work the Championship season was. I mean, Newcastle, you know, did finish top and finish as champions, and then a bit like the previous relegation, you look back on it and sort of think, oh, it was a fait accompli from the start. But it wasn't. It was a battle. It was, you know, it was tough week in, week out. That division is just, it's relentless, it's competitive, it's all those things. And, you know, he stayed in this alien environment for him, not knowing the division at all, starting again and getting on with it. And, yeah, I mean, obviously, the sadness is that we didn't get to see Rafa at the top of his game. Or to rephrase that, he might well have been at the top of his game, but he wasn't at the top of his game at a club that was at the top of its game. You know, he was at a club that didn't listen to him enough, that wasn't able to challenge at the top of the table, and eventually he had to go, obviously.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things that he did straight away from my point of view as a fan is that he made me feel connected to the club again in a time when I hadn't felt connected to the club for a long, long time. It had been a while since I'd been to a game at St James's Park. I had been sort of, you know, one of these people who decided to leave and not give my money to Mike Ashley. And when Rafa Benitez came back, and he just gave me that little sparkle, that little bit of hope again, that it could be different, that maybe Mike Ashley might think, oh, actually, you know, we've got a chance of doing something here. We could push on for Europe or whatever. And he had that ambition and that drive, and he wanted to take the club forward. But again, the club just didn't match his expectations and his ambition, and it didn't match what the fans wanted as well. And you know, we're seeing parallels of that now. We're in the same position now with struggling in the league and a manager that isn't doing himself any favours, but we're not going to see another Rafa Benitez, are we? We're not going to get another one of those.
There is no suggestion at the moment, unfortunately, that is going to be the case. There doesn't seem to be. And again, as we say, didn't actually manage to keep Newcastle United up, but they went down with momentum, if that's possible, in a bizarre sort of way. I mean, it took them a few weeks to start turning things around, and then the way that they ended the season, it just, everyone feels, so many supporters you hear and say, if he just arrived two games sooner, it felt like that wasted the matches against Stoke and Bournemouth, which if Benitez had come in sooner, had a little bit more time to work with them in that 21-day break or whatever it was, Newcastle could have come back. But as you say, what Benitez did, which Kevin Keegan did famously, obviously, and also Sir Bobby Robson did, was that the biggest asset that Newcastle United have is their supporters. They are the biggest asset that the club has, and to get everyone moving in the same direction, Benitez constantly spoke about that and trying to create this unity. And we had things crop up like Gallagher flags, which became war flags, and all these sorts of things, and everyone was, particularly in the Championship season and then the first season back in the Premier League, when there was a clear goal, this is what we need to get promoted this year, then it's we need to stay up. And the momentum sort of waned by the start of the second season back in the Premier League because the progress hadn't been made that he wanted. The changes were there. And to get everyone to buy into that again was more difficult. And that's the problem at the moment with Newcastle is there doesn't seem to be a direction. There isn't anything to get behind. There isn't anything to rebuild. And if your hope every season is just to try and avoid relegation, at some point you're going to fail at that. And at some point you're going to go down. And unfortunately, it's looking increasingly likely. There's a very good chance that could be this season. And that's what the concerning thing is. And I think that even if Newcastle survive this year, a lot of fans are worried about, well, if it's not this year, then it'll just be next season if a takeover doesn't happen, as at the moment it isn't necessarily going to. So that's the big frustration.
People sort of say that oh, it was PR with Rafa. You had a, you know, it was in the sense that he knew how to communicate with people. And he said the things that people wanted to hear. He spoke about why Newcastle could be good. And he spoke about Newcastle's history. He spoke about the potential. He spoke, but he had an idea about how those things could be reconnected. And he did it. And so, you know, part of that is about, you know, opening up and letting people in and letting people see the club for what it can be and everybody buying into it. And that happened. And, you know, and it created a very powerful bond. There are a couple of things to say. I mean, in this interview that we did, he did say, you know, he said that he had no regrets about going, that he felt that he had to leave at the end.
I didn't have any other option. In May, they knew that I was leaving. In January, I knew because I could see that there was not an ambition anyway. It's just carry on. And then at the end, when we had the last meeting, and I was assured that there would be investment in the academy and in the training ground, I could see that there was not any hope that it would be progressing or improving.
But the other thing, Taylor, though, he also said that he had no regrets about joining the club in the first place. And I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, it's important that we, you know, it might not have ended in the way that we wanted, in the sense that it didn't end with Newcastle winning trophies or being established in the top 10 or top 6 or whatever. But that part of history was actually quite important, because at least he helped us make us feel again. At least he made us feel something.
That second half of that last season when he was in charge is one of the most enjoyable times I've had as a fan for Newcastle, watching us at that point when Sean Longstaff came through after Almiron had signed and we had Perez and Rondon up front. I got an awful lot of enjoyment out of those games and out of watching the team at that time, to a point that I hadn't had for a long, long time, you know. And Rafa did that. Rafa made that team, and it felt like we were building towards something, didn't it? It felt like we had a direction and we had a purpose. In that second half of that season, you could see clearly where the club was going. You could see the balance that he had created and the way the team was playing and how he wanted to play. He kind of got them off the back foot and they'd become the counter-attacking force. This is why it feels so disappointing to me that he wasn't able to continue that. You know, as a fan, I would have been really excited to see where the club could have went with that. And who knows? Who knows? Obviously, he had to leave and he went to China, but he still has a fantastic connection with the club.
Clearly, you have a better connection with some clubs than others, no? And normally when you are successful and then you give everything, the fans appreciate that. And Newcastle United is this club, and the city is this kind of city, like Liverpool, Valencia, or Tenerife. You keep this connection, and now with the castle of I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. So I put an Instagram something about Ant and Dijk, and the fans go boom, 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 bombarded. So that has been really good. Then you have this feeling. So it's a part of your heart, and Newcastle United and the city will be home.
So there we go, Rafa Benitez, 5 years ago. It doesn't feel like it, does it? It feels like I said at the top, it feels like 5 minutes ago, but also it feels like a long, long time, and a lot of stuff has gone since he left.
This season feels like 5 years.
It does, doesn't it?
Oh, Sunday's game felt like 5 years.
Oh, Chris, I mean...
It did.
Chris, I do envy you the job you have and going to games and covering, but on Sunday I was sat on my couch with a beer and you were at the Hawthorns, and I thought I wouldn't swap places with you for the world.
I'm going to Brighton in a couple of weeks, can't wait.
Oh, that'll be a good run. Lovely stuff.
It was strange because as I say, I hadn't been to an away game in such a long time, and it was different to an away game because there isn't the sort of social element. I wasn't seeing other students, I wasn't seeing fans. But because we've been in this lockdown, actually the 7 hour round trip was in a strange sort of way. Refreshing probably isn't the right word, but it was a welcome change of scenery. The issue was the 2 hours that I was actually in.
It's always the case with Newcastle away games. The trip's always great. It's the 90 minutes of football which tends to fuck everything up for you.
Did you drive, Chris? Did you drive?
Yes.
Jesus, a man who can't use a razor and he can't shave his own head is allowed to be in charge of 5-ton...
A missile on the motorway. My Christ God. Almighty. Right, anyway, chaps, that's enough of that. Let's move on. This week's quiz is hosted by the one and only Mr. George Cook. And George, would you like to take over?
Yes, I would. Right, we're sticking with Rafa Benitez, okay? Because I think that's fair enough. And I'm sticking with the penalty shootout format that I did last time, because I quite enjoyed that. And for this week's quiz, we are in the Trent House. So we are just outside Leeds Park. We're stone's throw, we're a goal kick from the stadium, and we're in that great, bustly, nestly sort of pub. We're on the ground floor, there's a pool table upstairs, but we're supping pints of beer, and we're ruminating after one of Rafa's games in the Championship, and Newcastle have won.
Wow.
And do you know what? That is just a nice feeling, isn't it? Newcastle have won.
It's the 4-3 win over Norwich. We're there late in the night.
There you go.
All right.
Late in the night.
All right. It's late in the night. Beautiful, beautiful. And that Championship season is that great memory of, it doesn't really matter where you are if you're winning matches. Anyway, so I want to take you back to Rafa's first match in charge, okay? It's March the 14th, 2016. It's Leicester City, top of the table. Leicester City 1, Newcastle United 0. And Leicester win with a Shinji Okazaki overhead kick. Right, so it's the format, the same format as last time. I'm going to ask you to name players who appeared in Rafa's first game in charge. And if you get it right, you score a penalty. If you get it wrong, you miss a penalty. So it's kind of quite quick fire. Taylor, heads or tails?
Is it starting lineup? Just to check.
Yes, starting lineup. Heads or tails? Taylor.
Heads.
Right, it is a head. Do you want to go first or second?
I'll go second, please.
All right, so Chris goes first. I need to write this down. So members of Newcastle's starting lineup in Rafa's first game, Leicester 1, Newcastle 0. Over to you, Chris.
Moussa Sissoko.
Correct.
Gini Wijnaldum.
Wijnaldum, yes. Chris.
I believe Jack Colback was at left back.
Wow.
Oh, I thought that would catch you out, but it didn't. Scores with another penalty. Taylor.
Oh, God. Stephen Taylor.
Correct. Yeah.
Jonjo Shelvey.
Correct. 3 out of 3 for Chris. Amazing.
Taylor. I was there.
Oh, okay.
3 out of 3 for Chris. Daryl Yarnmott. Yes.
Correct. Well, I'm doing that with 3 gritted teeth. By the way, if it's still five all. Or if you've got the entire first team, we're going into substitute. So,
all right, okay, right, good, because I'm not going to say it right here because I already know what at least one of the subs was. I'm trying to think who started up front. I don't know this for certain, but I'm going to go Mitrovic, Alexander Mitrovic.
Correct, Mitrovic.
Oh, God. Who would have been in goal? It was well before Dubravka, wasn't it?
That's to say.
Rob Elliott.
Correct. Oh my goodness. 8 out of 8 for the starting lineup.
I think he was fit at this. I think he was playing. I always say Perez. Obviously out at Leicester City now.
Is correct, Chris. 5 out of 5. It's a perfect penalty shootout from Chris so far.
Shit,
Taylor.
Chris.
You've got 2 left from this team.
Chris, I wasn't counting on you being that good. who did we?
I think I know one of the other two, but I'm trying to think who the other one is.
Come on, don't put him off. You're giving him the eyes.
Jamal Lascelles
in the starting lineup is correct.
Well, that's the one I didn't think I knew.
Get
so,
in.
Oh, I think.
Right, oh. We are now in sudden death. So there's one member of the first team, the first 11 to name, and then we're going on.
So
to
am substitute. I allowed to go on to the subs?
I'm going to have to make a decision. Yes, you are allowed to go on the subs, and it can be non-playing subs. It doesn't matter whether they came on or not. I don't care.
I've got one who came on. The only appearance he made under Rafa Benitez, I believe, was Sidi Dumbia.
Fuck, I was going to say that. I had a feeling that was that game.
Dumbia was in the squad, yes.
Andros Townsend.
Andros Townsend. See, this has given us another kind of, this has opened up the... Fuck. The thing
I can't believe you've given non-playing subs as an answer, because that just makes...
Well, I just have to. Come on.
I think the last player... I think we're missing a midfielder, so I'm trying to think. I think it might be Vernon Anita.
Correct. So that's all of the first 11 now named. Sorry,
oh, God.
This is extraordinary.
Friggin' hell. Carl Darlow.
Tension. Carl Darlow was a substitute keeper, correct?
How are Chris? Oh. Come on, Chris.
This is ridiculous.
I don't know if he was in the squad, but obviously, famously, in McLaren's last game, Emmanuel Riviere started up front, so I'm going to have to go for Emmanuel Riviere because I'm running out of players I can remember.
You say Emmanuel Riviere. Where have you dragged that from, Christopher? Because you are right.
God.
Extraordinary.
What's
this is 8-7 in the penalty shootout.
God, I can't think of players now. I can't think of who's been said as well.
God, this is going to be the longest podcast ever. There's only three left.
God, I don't know. I can't think of any other players.
Mark McDonald.
Nobby Solano. No.
I'm not giving you any clues.
Sim De Jong.
Yes! De Jong is correct.
Come on, Chris. Come on, Chris.
Ridiculous. This is 8. I didn't even think he was there, but of course he was. Sim De Jong. Made out of broken biscuits.
And tarbash and glass.
I think he was injured, so I think this is going to be wrong, but I can't think of anyone else. Because I interviewed him recently, I'm just going to say him. Jamie Sterry. I think he was injured, so I don't think he was. But
oh, knob off, Chris.
Oh, God.
Is there anyone else in the squad?
There's only one left. I haven't worked out what to do with him.
I can't think of another footballer. I just can't think of one.
Nine, 8 in the penalty shooter. I was going to do two rounds of this, but this is the
end.
It's
going to have to be, isn't it? What happens if I get this right?
Well, we're going to go straight to the tiebreak.
Okay. Henri Saivé. Yes!
That's ridiculous. I cannot believe that.
No chance.
Are you both cheating?
No.
I cannot believe you've got the entire first 11 and all substitutes right.
That's incredible.
I'm going to have to get an elaborate system of cameras rigged up. And I mean, I already do have that, actually. But that's extraordinary. I don't know whether to take that seriously or not. I think you're both cheating. I think you somehow found out what I'm doing. That is nonsense. That is just nonsense.
Well done, Taylor. Well played, Chris.
That was quite a duel.
I wouldn't have got Savvy at the end.
That was quite a duel.
I would have named three people.
I was only thinking, Savvy's been here for so long that you could have named any game in the last 10 years and he probably would have been in. That's ridiculous.
Doumbia, I'm very, very dubious about Doumbia. I'm very dubious
Doumbia,
about
I mentioned Doumbia last week. I mentioned Doumbia the other week. It was one of the questions on the quiz.
I mean,
the
Doumbia
week.
I wouldn't have got. I wouldn't have got Jack Colback playing at left back. I would not have got that in the first 11. So I'm glad you said that, Chris, because that would have left me with no option.
That is ridiculous.
He had no left backs when he first came
in. How are we going to decide this, Chris? Is it tops off fighting the car park? Is that what we're doing?
I think it needs to be, yeah, in front of an open fire, actually. Like Oliver Reed in Women in Love. Right, so the second penalty shootout was going to be Rafa's last game in charge, which, of course, was Fulham 0, Newcastle 4. I'm just going to go through that. I don't care what you say. Dubravka, Hayden, Charles Lascelles, Dummett, Richie, Perez, Shelvey, Diame, Atsu and Rondon. I'm not going to do the subs.
Hayden was right wing back, if I remember correctly.
He was, wow. Yes. 5-4-1 formation. Yes.
Incredible.
But I want to know the attendance at Craven Cottage that day, and it's whoever gets closest.
I don't even know what the attendance at Craven Cottage is. I don't even know what the capacity is.
No, me neither.
Well, then that's a good question.
I know it's low, isn't it? Oh, is this not the time when they had one of the stands closed as well?
Well, I'm going to let Chris go first this time because Taylor went first with the... No, who went first with the penalties? Chris went first with penalties. Taylor, you have to go first.
Oh, God.
It's not that much, is it? Is it even above 30,000? I think... I can't remember.
Don't want questions, I want answers.
All right, Colgan. 29,500.
29,500. Okay, Chris...
27,384.
I've balls that, haven't I?
Okay, so Chris, you are this week's winner.
Yes!
Friggin' hell. The attendance that day.
He's finally lost.
The attendance that day was 24,000.
I knew it wasn't a very big ground. I knew I'd gone too high.
Oh my goodness.
Overshot.
I'm spent.
I am as well. I'm going to need to lie down after this. That's absolutely ridiculous.
What an extraordinary quiz. I mean, that was... We don't get much credit for penalty shootouts.
I mean, we were down to the goalkeepers taking pens there, weren't we?
That was ridiculous. That was absolutely ridiculous. I'm just checking that I got that right. Yeah, 24,979.
Oh, God. Well,
well
there
done,
you go.
Chris.
Thank you.
That's it, chaps. Well, Chris, well played, mate. Well deserved. I mean, you know.
Well, thank you. Just on the subject of quizzes, obviously on last Friday, we did have the Athletic's big Newcastle United quiz, which was a great success, raised a lot of money for Prostate Cancer UK. And for everyone who took part, thank you very much. There's some really big scores in it. But if you didn't get the opportunity to, then you can now play the Athletic's big Newcastle United quiz. If you just go onto the app and in the Newcastle United feed, it will be there. There's 40 questions, each multiple choice. You get 20 seconds to answer each of them. And yeah, just to test your sort of knowledge. And if you don't like any of them, then blame George. There you go.
Wonderful, wonderful stuff. Well, lads, thank you very much for your time, and thank you out there for listening. Please remember to hit the subscribe button so that you don't miss any shows, and leave us a review and a rating if you're feeling particularly generous, and we'll be back next week with another Pod on the Tyne. Thanks very much. Stay safe. Look after yourselves.
The Athletic.